Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 16th-ish, 2018, and welcome to episode 174 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way?
Are you going to say the other stuff? Or?
I don't know what I want to say. Maybe not.
Nah.
Okay.
Yeah, don't. Just say, just wing it.
Yeah, here we are winging it. This is a very special episode of the Retro Computing Roundtable. We are actually all in Minnesota, in Northfield, Minnesota, as it turns out, even though we come from disparate places. So I'm no longer Paul Hegstrom from Boston. I am, at the moment, Paul Hegstrom from Northfield, Minnesota. And with me at the very same table is Jack Nutting, also from Northfield, Minnesota, instead of from Sweden.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Jack.
How's the weather in Northfield?
It's terribly hot.
I agree.
Right. This is also the thing that we often do. And joining us also in Northfield is Michael Current, who is normally from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
That's so, right. And so, right now I'm also here with you guys, and yeah. I vote that it's hot here as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were unable to sort of set up the normal recording schedule because it turns out that Jack and I are both at this college reunion. So we thought we would just recruit Michael here and talk about retro computing topics just while we're here, rather than try to record a normal episode. The normal episodes will resume later.
And Michael is super interesting in this regard because Michael is the maintainer of the Atari 8-bit FAQ, yeah, which is like the ultimate resource of all the arcane wisdom of the Atari 8-bit machines.
Yes.
So, and it's funny because we all went to college together, and as far as I know, never talked about 8-bit computers at all.
Yeah.
I remember one time, Michael, poking my head into your room because I think you were living on the same floor as a friend of mine, and you had your door open.
Which floor?
I think it was Norse.
Ground Norse. Yep.
And I was walking past, and your door was open, and I poked my head, and I was like, hey, Michael, what's going on? And you were sitting there with, I think, an Atari 130XE, maybe.
That'd be right.
And you may have been, like, working on something, or even may have been playing a Klax-like game. I'm not sure which it was. It was something that I was like, wow, because I'd had Atari 8-bits several years before, and, like, traded them away and got an Atari ST and then later an Amiga.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, here's this guy using his old Atari at college. That's pretty cool.
It wasn't that old. I had it, I mean, that was like 2 years old at that time.
Okay.
I had the 130XE came out in 85. I got it in 89.
This is probably,
was about 90 or so.
I'm going to say it was probably 91 or 92.
Yeah.
I think something
well,
like
it's
that.
That's our sophomore year.
Sophomore, junior year, something like that. I'm not sure.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So
I think that's just like being on campus here where like there was such a, like, I kind of felt like left out in a sense because I had an Amiga, which I thought was better than everybody else's computer. And yet, like, it didn't work well with the systems that we had in here. Like, it was very much focused on, like, it was very much Mac and PC, like DOS PC. I guess there was some Windows happening, but it was very much like, in terms of like the general computing resources that the campus had, it was all Macs and PCs.
Yeah.
And you were here coming with something that was probably even more difficult to interoperate with than what I was doing.
I ended up with a modem, and I dialed into the VAX.
Yeah, yeah.
So you probably did it with your Amiga as well. So, you know, at that level, we're doing, you know, character-based telnetting or whatever. And so, I mean, you don't need a very fancy computer to handle that.
That's
true. Both of our computers are more advanced than a V200 terminal, so which is all we're emulating, so that worked out pretty well.
Yeah,
that's cool. So you could play better games though in between your VAX sessions than other people.
Yeah, that's true.
So at the time, did you, like, again, since I felt like kind of like the weirdo on the block with my Amiga, did you feel, like, what was your take on this as you were kind of using an older style computer? Like, it wasn't like decades old, right? But it was still kind of a previous generation.
I mean, it was. I mean, yeah. and yeah, I mean, any of us, I think, even at that point, you kind of have to have a feel for, yes, I'm going to be different, and I'm going to like it, and I'm going to tell people why I'm doing it, and
right.
why my machine is somehow preferable than whatever you have. So
right.
you have to have an attitude to go with it. But yeah, so I mean, that was my computer in my dorm right through college. I wrote papers. I did my faxing. I even did programming for at least one programming class I did on my Atari. I remember that fairly well. So
that's pretty amazing, actually.
you know, when you're demonstrating algorithms, the if one algorithm is fast or slow, that is readily apparent no matter how fast your computer is.
Right.
Yeah. So,
right.
So I was able to demonstrate exactly what I was supposed to be able to do using, and that I know that I was using Basic XE from OSS on my 130 XE at that time. So,
right.
Cool.
I did a whole class using that.
Cool. So. Yeah, I think that I had Basic XE. Back when I had 8-bits the first time around.
Okay.
In like 1985 or 6 or something.
And that's about when it came out.
Yeah.
When it came out after the XE computers did.
Yeah.
Because
I bought a 130 XE when it was quite new, and I'm pretty sure that I bought, it was something, it was some variant of Basic, that I think must have been Basic XE. And I remember, because it would do things like, it would let you access the upper 64K of RAM and things, and it would... In some way. I never did it, but I know that it could do it.
And it did it in a not useful way, but that's
why I didn't use it.
That's one of the few things that it was good for, was that. And it came in as a cartridge and disk combination to get the full language. So I try to think of other stories. I did Spanish classes. I wrote a vocabulary tester on my Atari, and that was in Basic XE, and that actually was big enough that it was using the more memory to pull it off. And
okay.
So I had fun. It was more fun to do the program than it was to actually learn the words.
Right.
I took advantage of the International Character Set
to
help me out with that. Yeah. So that was another thing I did in that machine.
So you, this was for a Spanish class, but you created a flashcard program for yourself.
Exactly.
That's nice. Excellent. Yeah.
And I mean, no one, I've never shared that anywhere. It's on a floppy disk I have somewhere still.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, limited interest program, I guess.
Yeah. You never know.
Yeah.
People like to see this stuff. So, at some point, I became aware that you had this Atari 8-bit FAQ. And this is probably, at this point, maybe 10-ish years ago that I stumbled upon this. And I was like, Michael Current. I think I know that guy. And I kind of put two together and figured, you know, understood that it was you because you'd had this back in college.
Yeah.
Like, at what point did you start maintaining or updating that? Was that an existing list that you kind of started working on, or did you build it up?
I started it from scratch. It was, I think the date on it tells me that it's 1992, which is the middle of our time here.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally done because I was the communication out there. There was the Comp Sys-Atari 8-bit Usenet news group, and then there was a internet based email list that was trying to reflect what was on a news group back and forth to people who were on email but not Usenet.
Okay.
And then there was a third thing on BitNet, which was not the same as the internet yet,
right.
Which was trying to reflect the internet mailing list to the BitNet group, and those things tend to fail from time to time, and everyone on all the groups didn't understand, and so there's constant barrage of people saying, why am I seeing this, why are you seeing this, and, you know, sort of have communication problems.
Okay.
And so I started this thing trying to explain how it all worked to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here's the different ways we communicate. Here's the FTP sites that are out there. And just going to pull together all the information about what resources are out there on the internet having to do with the Atari computers. So that's how it started.
Mm-hmm.
And over a very, very long transition, it's now become sort of this one author or one topic encyclopedia of 8-bit Atari computers from the perspective of a modern technology knowledgeable person, how right. do these old things work? And so it's evolved tremendously over the years, and I still work on it from time to time. I still publish it by posting it on Usenet for the very few people who even know what that even means.
Right.
And it automatically gets propagated in a few sites that still do that.
Right.
So it still goes, and it's a fun thing to keep learning all these intricate details and getting it, you know, internationalizing it has been a huge thing because none of us knew anything about the PAL machines from Europe back then, but eventually right. you learn that, well, not only is there PAL, there's also CCAM, mm-hmm. and there's all these different permutations around the world, and
right.
so I've learned more about the machines researching for the FAQ than I ever imagined. I mean, I've never done very advanced programming, but I understand a lot about the variations among machines and that
right.
kind of stuff. That it's sort of a technical writing that I don't know, I find fascinating. Every word counts. Every
yeah.
symbol, if you don't say it just that way, it's not right anymore. And so you keep having to rewrite things over again until you
sure.
Get it right.
Cool.
And so you're still adding to it now. Like, you still discover things that need updating.
I do. I'm trying to think of something recent that's happened. Just recently, there was. How am I ever going to explain this? There was sort of new evidence that there are Canadian, or there were Canadian 600 XLs that seem to have been distributed with 64K instead of the standard 16K.
Interesting.
Somebody was inside of a 600 XL and photographs of an upgrade. The upgrade, no one had ever seen this upgrade sold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But put two together, there have always been these mystery boxes that had a gold stamp on that said, now it's 64K.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, and I never knew if I believed that or not. I have no picture of those, but there's more than one description of them over the years.
Okay.
And now there's this new thing that describes an internal upgrade that does that. And it was, and that company I tracked down was also based in Canada. And so I'm probably not getting all the pieces in one place, but I realized that's what those were. They must have worked with that company to upgrade a bunch of machines and sold them as 64K machines for some reason in Canada.
Okay, so this third-party company would take a new 600 XL, install their own upgrade in it, and then put it back in a box and put that gold stamp on and say, now it's 64K.
Either they did or Atari in Canada did that, working
okay.
with them. I'm not mm-hmm. clear on that. If I saw that box, that would probably help me understand. I sort of revised my little references to those weird Canadian 600 XLs just mm-hmm. recently because of some new information that got posted on
right.
the Atari Age forum that I sort of realized was continuation of this old story. So I tend to forget, but until I realize, oh, there is that mystery that I couldn't figure out 15 years ago, and this is actually going to help me. And so that
yeah.
kind of thing, if you follow enough of the forums, you know, ongoing discussions and pictures that people post and stuff, you every once in a while there's something new where you realize that. That explains something that I did not understand before. Now,
right.
now I can go back and adjust again. So
nice.
That's cool.
It keeps happening. I always hope that it's eventually going to be so stable that there's rarely anything to add to it other than areas where I'm keeping up with modern devices or whatever.
But, right.
So that's happened to an extent, but I still work on it.
Yeah, there's still new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
New info about the old stuff, even.
Yeah.
So how much are you in contact with or following, like, what's going on or what went on with, like, the European users of this who, you know, the Eastern European? My understanding is that Poland and other countries, they started to get these later than, like they were selling them new in box in 1992 and that kind of thing. There's kind of a later generation who like ended up doing more stuff, and a lot of that is on the web, but in a format that to me is inscrutable because it's in Polish or it's in Czech or something. And like, you know, even the Lotharic SAO-TSD that I have, like the best documentation that I've seen is in Polish or something. And I don't understand it. It's beautiful documentation and I can't read a word of it. And like, I wonder like how much do you get feedback from any people on that side of that chunk of the world?
Well, yeah, it's the main fan of the FAQ list is this guy who is in, let's see, I should know this. I think he's in France or Belgium or something. But so he's just a big enthusiast, and he's always suggesting new things for me to work on or investigate. And so luckily he's not necessarily offended if I don't do everything he asks or suggests, but he seems to appreciate. So, and there's some contacts in Germany who are pretty, have been regular contributors or suggesters in the past as well. So yeah, and a little bit in the other like the ones you mentioned, Poland and Czech Republic, are a couple of the other hot spots. It sort of went, because you're right, it was sort of the early to mid-90s where, you know, Atari themselves never sold directly in Poland, but they sort of opened that once the political situation was different, they sort of got into that market, and they sold a lot there, and somehow the 16-bit machines were too expensive, and so 8-bit machines were what they were playing with at that point. The Ataris were huge in some of those Eastern European countries for a while. So that's where a lot of the today's users are and advanced programmers are. And I mean, speaking of languages, you know, Google Translate I use constantly trying to figure out things, and you're forgetting it once you get away from it, but you sort of get a feel for languages when you're doing a lot of that and trying to figure out, oh, now I understand the difference between these two similar words. So that happens fairly commonly as well.
Yeah, it's pretty excellent that Google Translate exists. I mean, like that is something that is something you really couldn't be doing 5 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe five, but only barely five.
And a big difference is whether Google Translate is translating something in text so that you can copy and paste and get Google to translate it, whereas if you're looking at scanned documentation of like a Polish disk drive or something where it's in an image that you can't just feed it in Google, then I spend time typing it in, typing in a language that you don't understand and can't even, you don't even know how to type all the letters or characters.
Accent or N or whatever.
Yeah. It's far more tedious and time-consuming effort way to figure out some of these things we're saying. But I have done a fair amount of that too.
Yeah, I think that the Polish documentation I was referencing is actually a PDF document, which I don't think Google Translate will touch at all. Can you make Google Translate actually?
No. Somehow, I feel like it depends. Doesn't it depend on the way you make the PDF? Sometimes it comes with text underneath it, and so then Google is able to pick it up.
Yeah, maybe so.
I mean, so I've never fully figured that out, but some PDFs seem to be like indexed by Google somehow, and some there's no way to search anything. So
cool. Well, so another thing that's in this FAQ is people and positions and hierarchies and org charts and that kind of stuff, right? You had been talking a little bit about that. So how broad is that? That sounds like a huge endeavor.
Yeah, so there's overlapping between two things I have or do. So the FAQ list, I try to have a sort of timeline of 8-bit Atari, the platform from beginning to end, from like the very beginnings of when they were contemplating putting together computers in the, well, right after they finished the VCS in about 1977, all the way up until, to the present day, who owns the rights to the platform today. But that, I think that, I don't remember which came first, but separately from my FAQ list entirely is this other website I have, which is Timelines of Atari History. That is doing Atari corporate history comprehensively, very much from the corporate angle, and so I have it organized by corporate entities, and so there's one from 69 or so to 76 when Warner bought it and started a new corporate entity, and so the next, that's another document in my timeline site which covers from when Warner bought it up until 2003, I think it is, when Warner shut down the Atari Holdings Incorporated, which was that corporate entity. But then I have more for the Atari Games Arcade after that split off, and for the Atari Adventure corporate entity, which was the arcade chain, one of two arcade chains that have been labeled Atari over the years. And so I have got a bunch of different pages tracking the different paths that it broke up into over the years. And then to link it back to the FAQ list, since that's where we started, I have duplicate information for information in my timeline that's specific to the 8-bit computers platform on my website and also in the FAQ list. And I do still carefully, whenever I am modifying something that's in the FAQ list timeline part, I do that in both places and vice versa. Periodically, I've wondered why I do that duplication, but I still like having the 8-bit specific timeline, and I like having it in the FAQ list, and so I still do it that way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I hadn't quite grasped that those two different two different projects, but I see. Yeah.
And I have a few other side things, but those are the two I'm sort of most proud of as sort of entities that I feel like my lifeblood has gone into. So the FAQ list, periodically I take deep dives into projects there, and then the timeline really can, you know, pull me in, and then I feel like I just can't get out for several days, and finally I sort of cover all the tangents. I keep falling down, and eventually I sort of pull out again and come back to life. It can really draw me in.
Right.
So I don't know if that's like a sort of kind of an illness or addiction or what. But
hopefully it's appreciated by the world anyway.
Right. I think it is. I mean, you get feedback in all kinds of weird directions. I've heard from Atari employees occasionally who find it on their own and want to help or give feedback or whatever. I know lots of other people use it. I have this weird... If I ever see anything that I wrote somewhere else, I always can sense it instantly, and so I can see whether or not they're crediting me, where people are using my work.
Yeah.
So I know. Yeah, it gets used all over the place. I mean, I have web stats. It gets hundreds of thousands of hits annually. So either it's all bots or it's actually a lot of users. I don't know which it is. But.
Well, the bots like their history as well, so.
Oh, yeah.
But you were on Antic, right? The 8-bit podcast with Kevin, right?
That's right. And Kevin, I think pretty early on in his Antic, it's the two of them, right? We're on the Antic podcast. But yeah, he interviewed me fairly early on in his podcast, which I find kind of crazy because he's done so many spectacularly cool interviews. It's like, why am I even in that mix? I don't understand that.
But one of the things I was thinking was that I don't know to what extent you're currently working with him, but there are, it seems like your two projects go together in some way. I mean, like he's been out finding all these people who like worked on the factory floors and stuff like that, and the interview that he found from some person might line up to a name that you have in your org chart.
I know that at least at times past, and presumably still, he has used my timelines to sort of pick and choose people he wants to try to track down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fact that I don't listen to every last interview he does, but I listen to many of them, especially when they're Atari employees, and very often they will inform me in some way, and then I go back and update my timeline as a result of what I just heard in one of his interviews too.
Sure.
Yeah. Sometimes I've kept up. I have, from a couple of years ago, I have probably more than a dozen good ones of his that I've listened to, but I've not seriously like processed in my language with my timeline. So I still have, I have a desktop of hundreds of files of things I want to go back and update either my FAQ list or the timeline or both at some point. And in those are a bunch of his interviews I've not gotten back to yet. But yes, I definitely his work informs my stuff, and at least probably a little extent the other way around as well. So I think there's a sort of a community of disparate people out there doing various things that tend to benefit from each other's work.
Right.
So and the net effect is that we all learn more together. So I do appreciate being a part of that.
Yeah, it seems to me, I mean, like, I wasn't really into the Atari stuff at all, you know, in the past, but it does seem like maybe the last few years, I mean, Kevin has made a huge push to just try to get everybody while they're still capable of giving interviews in a very wide array. And so, of course, what that means is that it is nearly impossible to listen to all of them. You know, I'm glad that they are recorded, and someday will listen to them, but they do come out really quite often.
Yeah.
Or at least they did. I think, you know, for whatever reason, I mean, it's quite possible that he's gotten through a lot of his list, and it also must have been a big effort to try to get all those out.
Right.
But, I mean, I periodically sort of have ideas that, oh, if only he'd interview this person. But I also think that he must have plenty of ideas, so I'm not sure he needs people telling him, go find this person.
Although you never know. I mean, like, if you come across names that there's a chance he doesn't know, can't hurt. I think he, from what I understand, he contacts many more people than he gets, you know.
Yeah.
That's another thing I was going to ask, because I know Kevin does some like FOIA requests and things like to like just try to get information on people from Atari or actual like Atari documents, like looking for FBI files or just other, you know. And I was wondering if that's something you
somebody else did that freedom of information work. Yeah. FBI that was, you know, there was this whole business where Atari seemed to be maybe not so legally working around the when there was this DRAM shortage and you weren't supposed to be importing them, and they seemed to have some back channel way they were getting around it. And I forget the guy's name, but somebody else who wasn't Kevin delved into that pretty deeply and was able to document a lot of the sort of odd things that were happening, shipping going to weird places. And so, yes, I have utilized some information from there. In my timelines, I don't really have any reference to that whole saga, but there have been documents in there that helped me pin down when certain things happened, when people came and left, and that kind of stuff. So
do you actually sort of try to contact people, like the people on the org chart or whatever, yourself? I mean, like, not for interviews, not so much, but just for asking questions.
My habit is to not do much of that. I sort of, for one thing, I've got such a giant backlog of material anyway. I don't need it to be going out further to generate more. I like working with, I've decided, because I have done a little tiny bits of interviewing or talking with people, I decided that I'm best, and maybe my role in this world of stuff is working with documents, things that are in writing, and deciphering them and figuring out, when you got six different things that are saying six different things, what is the actual fact here? What is the most likely thing that actually happened? And so I think, you know, I feel like that's sort of my strength. Being from the library world, you know, I actually travel to libraries for this, specifically to tap stuff that no one has scanned anywhere yet, and contribute to my timeline, especially using material like that. So I like working with especially primary source documents from the time period, and less discussing with people today. A lot of time, I mean, those interviews that other people do are amazing. It's great that people do that. I did it once, and I felt like this isn't what I do. I do something else. So
right.
Yeah. I talked to Bill White, the nearly original VP of finance for Atari. And it was really cool. He actually reached out to me first, and I enjoyed doing that, but I also decided I'm not going to do things like that as much. So.
Yeah, but doesn't it really help feed into your process of making the documents that you're, like, the documentation that you are creating? Then it's not useful to your task, essentially.
It can be pretty daunting, even if it's somebody who held an important position in the distant past. It's still a little bit freaky to talk to somebody who was so much in charge of, you know, VP of finance. Sounds like a pretty big position.
Freaky is a nice term, right? Another, I mean, the thing is, especially at a company like Atari at those early days, it's everyone had egos back then, and they probably never quite let go of it. And so if you interview a bunch of people, you're going to get different stories.
Right.
And now I'm going to sort this out. I don't want to be in that role. I want to be documenting, facts. Or at least if I can't verify it directly, at least someone could, in theory, verify it somehow.
Right.
Those are the kinds of things I like to work with, I decided. Yeah.
We, in the context of an Apple III podcast that I'm on, we've talked to a couple people that, so one of the people was the person who did all the circuit board layout for the Apple III board, and the other one was the one who basically designed the machine.
Okay.
And it's like, that's crazy, right?
Right.
But the thing that would worry me would be just like, getting yourself in such a prepared enough that you could ask enough questions and ask the right questions and not not sort of burn any future bridge for anyone who might be better prepared after you. Like, if you give them a bad interview experience, they may say, all right, I'm done with interviews. This is dumb.
Right. Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to be the one who caused that to happen.
Right.
But it is. I think it is, on the other side of it, it is actually pretty cool that, these are people often who aren't in such big positions anymore. No one wants to talk about this stuff with them. And like, it's sort of like now that all the dust has settled and, people's, anger has subsided, then it actually is possible to kind of like talk to the people who are actually behind the scenes, So anyway, whatever. It's I can understand the pressure. But it is also interesting, like looking at this more historical stuff, like how big the names are that you can get.
Right. Actually, now that you mentioned that, it makes me think about, I know that one of the things that Kevin has mentioned many times is his inability to get an interview with Alan Alda.
Yeah. I remember hearing that too. Yeah.
And maybe the cause, just like you were saying, maybe sometimes somebody did really give him a really poor interview about like that time in the 80s you were pitching stuff for Atari.
Yeah.
And then, maybe after that he decided, man, these people, I don't want to deal with these kind of nerds anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Who knows?
Or could have, just recently I was reading something where he was still under contract with after the Turmel takeover, and somehow that went badly.
Mm-hmm.
They paid him off, or they didn't pay him off when he was supposed to be paid for another $1 million for another couple of years. And I could also imagine something like that happened, where he just got turned off to the whole experience.
Yeah, could be.
But that's,
We may never know.
We may never know.
Yeah, and as time goes on, it gets more and more likely that we won't know.
Right.
It's like, some stuff just is not written down anywhere.
Yeah.
And, that's one thing that is nice about what Kevin is doing, is even if he's getting four different stories from four different sides, at least they're there to evaluate later.
So, right.
People's recollections, however accurate or whatever they are, they're still they were there. I mean, that's the cool thing, because a lot of us are just sort of find it interesting, but we didn't get to actually be there. So.
Right. And assuming that all these people are giving interviews in good faith, like I don't think anyone is lying on purpose, but people have different recollections. Mm-hmm. But that it's still all extremely useful to hear what people who were there say. Cool. Well, how much time do you actually spend apart from actually working on like these documentation products that you have? Do you actually use Atari 8-bits much these days?
I
collect or anything, or
probably the main. I mean, the one thing that keeps me using at least a little bit is that we still have an active functioning user group up in the Twin Cities, St. Paul Atari Computer Enthusiast Space.
Okay.
I've been a member of that since. Late 90s? I don't know. I've been the president for a long time. It's a monthly. They meet monthly. They still. It's like it functions. It's the way they all used to do. Meets monthly, produces a disc of the month every month.
Mm-hmm.
Money by going and buying a disc, floppy disc, and then so I show up two or three times a year because I don't live very close to there anymore. But I show up sometimes, and I buy all the discs since I was there last time. And then over the next few weeks or a couple months, I work my way through all the discs I just bought. And so that's one thing that keeps me booting up the Atari and actually checking out the latest software on the actual hardware.
Right.
And so that's probably probably the main thing. And I'm one of the main people who goes and just sort of keeps track of new software coming out and sends them off to the other guy, who Glenn Clersherman, who actually makes the discs.
Okay.
So, so I'm the main person who finds stuff for him to put on discs.
Right.
And there's enough that he never runs out.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, all the shows, which are, you know, all European things. We have those things to show up on our discs of the month.
Right.
After a while, and then, you know, the other uses are just sort of, you know, we've all had our lives where any opportunity you have, when you have people over and you want to show off your fun games, and that you want to see if they, how they react, and so I do that from time to time. We had a little party for graduating student workers at my university who worked for me and were graduating at my place, and I got to show off a few games, and they found them fun and exciting, as people always have. So I still enjoy the fact that the games are as intriguing to people now as they ever were. So.
Yeah. I mean, some of these games have an incredible staying power, like Star Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
I introduced that to my youngest child with some friends at the house, and they just got engrossed, and like the first time they played it for hours.
That's awesome.
And their kids who otherwise were playing TF2 and before that Minecraft, like very much in like 3D worlds with advanced graphics and stuff, and they just found this thing fascinating. This thing of like switching between the different, you know, the map and the tactical and all these, you know, and it was like, and it continued for a while. When the friends would come back, they'd be like, can you hook up your Atari again so we can play this some more? And that was a lot of fun to see.
Do you think that could be, I'm just imagining, it could be because it leaves more to the imagination, and so it occupies more of their brains.
Yeah.
So it's not just giving all the details themselves. It's your free to make your stories. Because, of course, we did that when we were kids, too. We had Star Raiders. My big dream was to have Star Raiders on a colossal size screen, and you pretend you're the captain in the captain's chair, and your co-pilot is working the...
Right.
The keys and the keyboard, and so we
and now like
that.
that's in our grasp, then, right? Like I'm playing this on a 65-inch television. It's incredible. Like it's a dream come true.
But you can still invent the whole scenario around it, and you can sort of invent roles for multiple people to contribute to the game, and it's still actually challenging to get the highest rating in that game. And if you don't figure out that shields are a big drain on your not only your power but also your score in the end, so you turn your shields off at every opportunity as you march through the highest level. That's the key to getting the Star Commander Class 1, which we all learned in the 80s. So if you haven't heard this before, then now you can go play and see if it improves your score.
Have you ever played this game, Ball?
I have not. I think I've seen it, but I do have. So I have a lot of junk. I have many, many different computers and things. I got the Interact showed up, and also the toy luggable.
Oh, right.
That I bought on the last one. But I have all kinds of stuff, and I do have a couple of Atari computers which I haven't really fully set up. So I have like, the big disk drives, and I in fact had I've probably bought three, I think, of the 800s, you know, the old ones.
Yeah.
And it seems like they are basically plastic around a lot of air and then some heavy stuff. And so what that means is that the first two wound up in pieces, you know, and shipped, and they didn't make it to me properly. Because the plastic got brittle, and there's nothing. All it takes is a bump because it's just space in there.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but I think I do have one that is intact, intend to try that out.
Because the great thing about Star Raiders in particular is it's on a cartridge. You don't need to worry about disk drives. You just pop in the cartridge, plug in a joystick, and you're good to go.
Yeah.
Well worth it.
Okay. So, I will definitely try this.
And to me, it's always super interesting that this game, which everybody loves and everybody knows about in the community at least, like is one of the first games. It was being built, it was being worked on before the hardware was even done.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are certainly games that graphically look a lot better in terms of more use of color and things like that. But there's something very compelling about it, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, even outside the Atari world, that's the one I hear about. If there's one game, you know, it'll be Pitfall 2 on the 2600 in Star Raiders on the 8-bit.
Yeah.
And it won. I just fixed up this in my FAQ list recently. It won a well-known Game of the Year, and that was 1982, and the game came out in 1979. So it was like it was still like the most relevant thing, like 3 years after it came out.
Right. That's interesting.
That's cool. But do you have a functioning Atari? Do you have the original one?
I have a bunch of functioning ones. Okay. As far as I know, they're mostly functioning. So I have. I mean, I have most of the 8-bit models in my, a 130XE is set up in under the 50-inch LCD flat screen TV, and which I bought specifically knowing that it would have a gaming mode, and then I route the video through my receiver, which allows me to use the S video output of the computer.
Okay.
So not only is it big screen, it's also the clearest picture I had ever seen the Atari put out before, because I had never done that, and I never had a separate chroma video monitor in the day either. So it's pretty awesome having this giant screen. You can't use it for, I mean, I don't have any long cables, so if I'm going to type, I'm like right under the TV. But it's pretty awesome for playing games. And I've got like a, you know, those 25-foot joystick cable extenders, so you can sit back and play Missile Command in the couch while you're Peter's up there.
I just have mine connected with. I have a composite video out to the TV, and I just bought like a really long cord with the Atari plug at the other end.
Oh, okay.
And so I think it's like a 4-meter cable or something. So I can very easily put the computer just on the coffee table at the couch where I'm sitting, and it had just a cord running across the room of the TV.
That's actually a better solution. You should think about that.
It's pretty nice, because otherwise, the keyboard being too far away is not much fun.
Yeah, good point. But models I have, let's see, I can probably easily go by what I don't have. I don't have a 1200X, I don't think, and I've always wanted an XE game system.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think I've been sort of half looking at those. I think, Jack, you recommended this is a good kind of starter system.
Right.
I suppose you do want a keyboard with it.
Yeah, as long as you get the keyboard with it. Yeah. That's pretty crucial. I see them sometimes in eBay, they're selling without a keyboard, and it's kind of useless.
But that one has only one slot, right? It doesn't have one
cartridge slot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is true of everything except for the 800.
Okay.
Only the 800 has two, and the right side slot was used for very few things.
Yeah, okay.
So, I've also never had... I never had a 1200XL. I never had an XE game system. Both those things I would like to have. Have you ever seen in person a 1450XLD?
No.
No. Me either.
No, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So this for the uninitiated, I think I may know what you're talking about. Like, there's a brochure or something that shows this sort of like computer with disk drives on top of it or something like that.
Yeah, like it kind of looks like an Apple III in some ways.
Yeah.
Like it's a computer that's design-wise is a lot like the 1200XL, but had built-in disk drive, I think, and a spot on the left where it looked like you could stick something else maybe, but it was not really. And like, I think they announced several different models that were similar, like that some were going to have like an extra audio chip or something. Was that something different?
That was summer of 83 where they announced four new machines, 600XL, 800XL, 1400XL, 1450XLD.
Right.
So the both the 1400 and 1450 had the built-in modem. Somewhere, and also a speech synthesizer chip, so that could be what you're thinking about. And then the XLD had the disk drive as well. And so those were announced in summer 83, and the 1400XL was canceled late that fall. They sort of admitted to it January 84. And then the 1450 kind of stayed in limbo longer. They sort of restarted the engineering in the spring of 84. Before that got sort of canned the last time around when Termel came on the scene. Summer 84.
But a number of at least prototype level things were produced. Like, there are a number out there, right? In the dozens, probably?
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, it's always it's hard to understand. Some things exist in prototypes, like there was one.
Yeah.
Maybe they made like three for a show or something. But other things, at least the old Atari, would actually go and make little mini production runs of things. And
right.
So I don't understand how manufacturing works like that. But yeah, so that's one of those things where there seem to have been a fair number produced. I know there's some pretty different variations out there. Some the earlier ones have one kind of motherboard or maybe more than one board in them, where the later ones in 84 they sort of reworked it all, and so those are these tong boards that are these mammoth single boards in there. And so there's people out there with different kind of variations of them. You know, for my work, I sort of long ago sort of decided I don't want to be trying to figure out all the details of all these unreleased products, because I've always had the impression there are way more unreleased products than people ever even heard of. And so I sort of have basic coverage of anything that Atari ever announced.
Okay.
If they didn't announce it, if it didn't made it into the media in some form, then my timeline, my documentation isn't trying to talk about it, leave other people to delve into what was in the back closet and all that kind of stuff. Right. What did they find in the dumpster and that sort of thing.
I remember seeing maybe like a year ago or half a year ago or something, I saw on eBay it was a double disk drive. It kind of looked like a stacked version of the normal.
Yeah. So there's an 815 that was produced also in small quantities.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that one actually made it out, but just not very far.
My take, and it's probably a little controversial, take is that it never really made it out. They made some. They made probably several dozen, but I don't think it ever really was released.
Okay.
I think maybe even some were sold, but I think there is no normal production run of them.
Okay.
I also, speaking of things, some people do find those fascinating. It's fairly recently became clear to me that those things could not do, I hope I got this right, could not do single density. They were double density only, which means they couldn't do anything unless you bought or made your own double density disc, because, of course, everything that was sold was single density at that point.
Yeah, that's sort of...
That's interesting.
Problematic. I mean, the thing is, but the device is gorgeous. I don't know what it is. I mean, like, the 810 is not that fantastic. It's not terrible, but somehow the 815, you said it was? That there's something just beautiful about it. Like, I don't know. Anyway.
Slightly different form factors, taller and stuff.
Different
overall shape.
It looks, if it's not true, it certainly looks as though the top and the bottom halves of the case are identical. Like, they actually designed it to be interchangeable.
Flip the disc.
I always found that curious.
But have you ever seen one of those?
I imagine you're about to ask me that. I don't think so, but sometimes I've wondered if I saw one at a place called Castle Communications in Lansing, Michigan. There was an Atari, dealer there. We stopped by there a couple of times, and they had a bunch of stuff. And I know that we were shopping for our system when that was being promoted, so... I almost feel like there could have been one there.
Right.
But,
like maybe a demo model for the dealership.
Yeah, exactly. I know that I have the catalog of that time with a Castle Communications stamp on it with prices for most of the hardware handwritten on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a price there for the 815,
right,
as if they could sell us one.
Right.
So, it could have been that there was one there.
Yeah.
I bet it would be pretty interesting. I mean, like, I'm sure people have done this, but it would be pretty interesting to talk to just dealers, the people who were dealing with the what Atari sent them, and then what they told the customers and what their discounts were, and, how the pricing structures changed and stuff. I mean, similarly, it would be interesting to talk about that with Apple, dealers and so forth, or it seems like it's a segment that I don't feel like we hear much about, the guy who owned the store who was authorized to do repairs and had all the parts and knew, which parts went where and things like that, and had all the internal documents. And some of those things for Apple, some of those things at least have come out, like people have scanned all the technical stuff that their store had and things like that.
Right.
And I assume for Atari too, it's just I haven't looked.
Yeah.
But,
I think it's an internal price list
that's been
coming out off and on over the years. And I love those things. Those piece help me piece together when things came out, because I'm confident that things did not come out. If Atari says it's still coming, I'm pretty sure it's not out yet, because they wouldn't say that if they had gotten it out yet.
Right.
And so I've done a lot of timeline adjustments as I've come across some of those official price list sheets that Atari has come out with and people have scanned.
So here's a question about your process for, like, say, updating that document and making changes. Mm-hmm. Like, when you have new evidence, do you have some sort of source document or system for referencing between these things? Like, you might have 10 different pieces of paper that indicate to you what the timeline for a product was, that they don't all need to be mentioned in your FAQ, but you probably keep track of them somehow.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I have definitely evolved over the years because, well, first of all, when you're starting, you think that this source is not anything to question. This is just right. I'm going to put this in, and there's no reason for anyone to look it up again, because everything else will prove this was right.
Right.
And then after a while, as I start to realize that, oh, I revisited this before, but this is saying or suggesting something different, now I have to go find my first source and look at them again to see if I look at them next to each other, if I can make sense of how I can make these both be true, or do I have to somehow decide that one of these is not correct?
Hmm.
Usually it's the former. Usually it's that there is one thing that's correct and I just interpreted wrong the first time. Once you've got a second perspective or something, then you can realize, I understand what I should have made sense of the first one. And so you can piece things together that way. So so I have a extensive collection of documents on my computer that is organized by how I want to find them again in the future, which has become more and more valuable over time, because as you revisit things repeatedly, as new information comes out, you keep taking wider swaths at once, and so you have to find everything over again. When there are online sources I can link to directly, I like to do that these days. I'll do that there's all sorts of scenarios. Like if you've got three different sources, but you think this is the one that is definitive, then maybe I'm just going to that one. If I'm sort of piecing together something from several different sources, none of which sort of suggest that directly, then I'd like to reference them all if I can. Mm-hmm. If I have something in sort of tangible format and it's not online somewhere, then maybe I will reference like a magazine or newsletter or something without a link, because there's nothing to link to. I don't know if I'm really answering your question exactly. It's like yes, there's a system, and I mostly, the thing is, what I'm doing, I hope, is I really want and believe it's valuable for the world, but I'm also doing it because I'm so interested, and I'm sort of I'm citing things in better and better ways for my own benefit and my own interest, because the next time I revisit it, I want to have it. I don't want to reproduce all that many steps all over again, and so I leave myself enough clues that I can get back and do it again. Right. And by doing that, you're citing it in a way that other people can trace your steps as well. So many of my links have broken over the years, and so then you see if webarchive.org captured it, and so you fix your link to point to their archive copy instead of the original copy. Do that from time to time.
You can actually submit them too. Like if it's still working, and it might someday not work, you can actually just say, like, record this one. Might be worth doing that at some point.
I thought about that.
But yeah, so what you are doing, it sounds like you have a big, massive set of data, and you are distilling it. If you included all of the stuff that led you to this decision, then in a sense you're just giving everybody just like the big pile of data that you had to work through in the first
place. That's right.
Right.
I mean, what I feel like my contribution is piecing together dates or times or connections that are not readily discernible by looking at a single source.
Yeah.
And it's hard for people probably to realize how much work goes into some of these things I've pieced together. I can tell you that back when I started doing this in around 08 or so, I would claim that the internet basically did not realize that when Atari broke up in 2 and 84, that Warner still owned Atari Games, the arcade division, for another 6 or 8 months before they sold that to, half sold it to Namco in the beginning of 85. You couldn't have figured that out by cruising the internet. When I first actually bought some corporate records from California for these companies and saw those dates there, I put that on my timeline, and you know, now it's all common knowledge, but someone had to piece it together in the first place. I can't claim that no one knew it beforehand, but I think I helped it be widely understood.
Right. Whoever knew it did not document it in a public way that anybody could find.
Sure. And so that was kind of one of the early things that I felt like I was making much more readily known than had been previously. And it's just it keeps going and going and going. And I can't believe how big these things are. And, yeah. And so many other people are doing related things, but in different ways. You know, there's been books that have come out, and some books want to be definitive. But if you're working in a parallel process, I know all kinds of ways some of these definitive books aren't, because I've had to deal with them, and I figured out where they're right and wrong, and I don't tell the world where I have made those judgments. I just make my timeline reflect what I think is more precisely accurate and move on from there. So when you compare things that have been published in books in my timeline, if there's a difference, it's very often because it's on purpose on my part.
Right.
And you have an opinion as to which one is right.
Yeah. And not always. And I'm always quick to say, I mean, I'm one of the great things about a website is that you can keep fixing it. And I very commonly realize that, oh, I got that wrong before, and now I understand. I just did this in the last few days. Scott Stelfin at AtariCompendium.com put up, and he has a bunch of interviews. He has known with someone who was pretty far down in the design level in the early Atari, 73 to 75. But that included a story about one of his bosses, Lloyd Warman, who was the VP engineering at Atari for a very brief amount of time, in 74, basically. And there's almost nothing out there about this guy. And I couldn't figure out when he left, because one of his own sources says he left in 75. But Steve Bristow, according to his own resume, which I have a safe copy of on my computer, became VP engineering in November of 74. And so what do you do with that? Is one of them wrong? Or is there something else that I don't understand?
Right.
But now, thanks to this new interview where he's talking about stories about Lloyd Warman, this guy and Warman went off and did engineering for arcade sites that Atari was designing, not just supplying things, but actually designing the whole place and actually designing different cabinets to put their games inside of. Leisure Time Game Centers, they were calling it. And they were doing those in the 75. So now I figured out, well, now there's a reason for him to have still been there when he wasn't VP engineering anymore. And so now I understand how it can be that Alcorn came back and took engineering back in spring of 74, because the first of these Leisure Time Game Centers came out in May of that year. And so now it all fits together.
Right.
I love when you can just get a little more information and suddenly and it just sort of fits in your timeline, because that happens when most of what you have there is right and you're only missing a little bit of information to make more pieces click together better. So that's a very recent example. You do have to
like remember why you put 74 or 75. Like you have to go back and figure out.
And I did that. I had to go find my some of my files are by name, and so I had to go find what I have on Warman and remind myself why I was questioning the dates. And in this case, I was remembered it all pretty well, because that one has perplexed me for years. Even though Alcorn is such a major figure, figuring out what his title was throughout his tenure is not that easy. Mm-hmm. So I've tried to do that in a variety of ways over time, and this helped with that as well. And so that's another thing. You make one little change, but you have to realize what that does to your timeline and read through a bunch of other things. Who else had this title before and after? When does name show up? When they leave? And so tweaking my timeline tends to be more than a simple tweak. You have to revisit a lot of things in order to do it well. So again, this thing that I'm sure people just look at as a bunch of facts, we're just reproducing facts. Well, but it takes a lot of effort to produce it in the form that it is, and I don't know. I don't know how much appreciation there could be, but I just know that I enjoy it immensely, and whether people get it or not, I think I know people use it, so that's that's good enough.
Well, I'm glad you do it, and I get it. Like, to me, it's obvious. I mean, even if nothing else, just the sheer size of the fact, like, that's obvious there's a ton of work into it. And then to see that you put out updates that have, you know, small changes that are important, because you found things that are, you're trying to hone in on the truth as much as possible.
I find it amazing that it's actually that deep. I mean, like, this is 1977 or something like that is as far back as this really goes, right? 1976. But I mean, like, it's not ancient Egypt, you know? Why is it so hard to actually find these things? But it's really deep, you know? Like, it doesn't take very long to get to a point where there's, you know, it's either no fact or a controversy, you know? So
it's interesting where, you know, and I'm a librarian, and so most of our databases go back to the 80s, and we can only research in the 70s. Well, suddenly it gets much harder because no one cares about the 70s.
trying to forget it as much as they can.
It's interesting how that can be. And just, you know, just history of Atari. I mean, you can see, you know, Atari was everywhere in the early 80s. They were Silicon Valley, and so there's tons of material on that time period. Mm-hmm. But early 80s, did they go to the summer CES in 1980? Or I don't remember if it's 80 or 81. One of those years is like, how could they have not been there? And yet I can't document that they were there.
Yeah.
How is that possible? No one covered them? Were they not there? How is that possible? They were humongous.
Right.
It's a, you know. And then the end of Atari Corporation, the Jaguar era. You know, that's like 10 years newer. And yet, because they were smaller and less important, there's far less information to work with. And so that is another era that actually is very difficult to work with.
Right.
So, it's interesting how some things that you think would be not that hard to piece together can be and have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've done a little bit of... I've been witness to some similar kind of work on the Apple side, you know, I can sympathize at least. I mean, it definitely is. There's a lot of intricate relationship stuff, and particularly, I think actually both companies got big rapidly.
Yeah.
You know, so then that confuses things. I mean, when it's 19 people in an office, you know, you can kind of keep track of them a little bit, even though I guess it's not well documented at that point. You know, everything is very fluid. But
right.
Apple grew out of Atari, basically. I mean, everyone should know that.
Yep.
It's not just that Steve Jobs sort of... That's another thing. What was Steve Jobs' role with Atari when he started Apple? That is super hard to figure out. I don't know if I understand that. Was he gone? Was he a consultant? Was he wandering in and out without getting any money from Atari at that point?
Right.
I don't know the answer to that. I have tried very hard to figure it out, and I that's one of those things I gloss over in my timeline. I don't know what his status was. But Ron Wayne, he was an Atari employee when he was helping the other two found Apple.
Right.
And then he decided that was a more stable, longer-term job than staying with Apple, so he quit right away.
Yeah.
Ron Wayne's role with Atari is also very hard to figure out, even though he wrote a whole book about it, which I have read. And yet, but what was your role? I think it's like he figured out that he doesn't have a role. He just sort of go fly around the world and meet the subsidiaries internationally, and otherwise we don't really care what you do at this point. We just want you out of the local office or something.
But it does sound my impression is that there, at least at a time, Atari was relatively loose in its just sort of corporate structure and behavior.
It seems to be. It seems like there was a lot of sort of, you know, playing fast and loose with the idea of even what a company was supposed to be doing in some ways. And so I think that probably, to some extent, like these things like what title somebody had at a certain chunk of time is probably almost impossible to know now, because probably it wasn't even clear at the time. You know, it's entirely possible someone was an employee, and from 1 week to the next, it's okay. Well, now you are this, and didn't get a new employment agreement necessarily. Just like, okay, now we're putting you in charge of this. This is your title. But they weren't a big corporation that had procedures probably for like making that kind of thing official. So it probably isn't even necessarily documented. You know, maybe a pay change is all that happened. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there are various eras. I mean, the very beginning, nobody had any titles, and then at some point they decided, well, Bushnell, I'm going to be president, and Dabney, you're going to be vice president or something like that. And so they sort of invented titles, you know, after they'd been there a while.
Yeah.
Once you get into the Warner era and the Kassar era, then I think there were lots and lots of titles.
Yeah, then it's
which
different.
Probably everything got sort of pinned down in certain ways. I feel like I don't have any business background, but I feel like I have this weird, unique understanding of how corporations can be constructed and put together because I've researched this one company through many variations, through many different eras, and so I have appreciation for, I totally understand why people are interested in all the star programmers and the hardware engineers, but in order for a company to operate, you need finance people, you need legal people, you need marketing and sales, and so one of the things I've felt I was contributing to the world is making sure all those names were out there and accounted for, and so I learned a lot about some of those areas and what titles could be and what they could mean and what the roles were. So, which you kind of have to do if you're going to try to figure out who replaced whom and when they came and left and deal with, LinkedIn sites are great, but a lot of people are not particularly precise with how they account for their own history. And you don't always realize that until you put them several together and say, oh, they're just guessing.
They remember it was sometime in the 80s, and so they put it in the
form.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it was the episode before this one was one where we were kind of imagining what would happen if either IBM or Microsoft hadn't been there somehow and like somebody else was taking over. And one of the problems with Atari seemed to be kind of from a business marketing angle. Like somehow, I mean, it seems like this was kind of a constant issue with these companies. Like somehow Tandy did not take over. Why that is, we don't know. They should have. They should have. I mean, I don't know the story very well, but I mean, it seems the way my impression is that people think they were just spending a lot of time shooting themselves in the foot, you know?
Right.
Commodore 2.
Yeah, they both seem to have like a lot of squandered opportunities.
Yeah.
Just because they didn't have, maybe didn't have the right people doing the right jobs in terms of marketing or business decisions of various kinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean. Unless we actually were working there, I think we all tend to be speculating. My opinion is that tends to be pretty generous about thinking that they weren't a bunch of incompetent business managers. I think no one knew what the right way to go was because they were all inventing the industry at that point.
Right.
And so I think, to me it's a little harder to blame the marketing people or the heads of the companies or whatever about this direction or that. I bet they were all doing their best and all thought they were doing what was right. And so I make a point of not trying to demonstrate any sort of judgment in my timeline sorts of things. But that'd be my I don't have any big negative feelings about Bushnell or Kassar or, who's the third one? James, I can't even think right now. or Turmel. Yeah. It's very popular to hate Jack Turmel and the Turmel family, but I'm impressed with them all. They ran these cool companies for extended periods of time, and they hired a bunch of people, and they put a bunch of products out, and that's all. It's all cool to me. So.
Yeah.
And it is a little. Maybe I did come across a bit negative there, but
I'm sort of reacting to what you hear.
Oh yeah.
From many people.
Me too. I think it's. I guess it is. It is probably true that we can't tell for sure how it would have been different if they'd done a different thing. I mean, like.
Right.
So, I hear in that little exchange we had some echoes of things that I hear with current Apple. Like there's always Apple will do anything. Doesn't matter what. And then a bunch of people say, oh, this is the death of the company, and, you know, they've gone, you know, they're going to fail next month. I mean, and often it turns out that it was okay, you know, that
right.
decision worked out after all, you know. But, I mean, you know, so to the extent that there are all these people who immediately say, whatever it is, it must have been bad, you know. those people may also be doing the same thing with, you know, the what happened. We sort of know the outcome with Atari and Commodore and Tandy, and how we could have avoided that outcome, we don't know.
Right.
So
it's like you said, they were inventing the industry. Yeah. No one knows what's coming around the corner. Mm-hmm. Everyone's trying to sort of guess and say, okay, we think this will be a good strategy for what we think might happen.
Right.
And nobody knows what's going to happen. So.
But it still would have been. It would have been interesting if it had turned out that, you know, Atari had come up with a thing that beat the Mac, you know, to the
right.
world or whatever.
Right. But actually, I have a question for you that I don't know if this is in your FAQ or not. It was something we talked about in our previous episode. Was that? Because I've seen this on the internet somewhere before. Like there is a story that at some point Atari was talking to IBM in probably the late 70s about some sort of IBM-branded Atari 800 variant kind of thing, and there are some pictures of what looks like a, you know, a casing for this. And so I posited this as one, like, possible thing. Like, what if IBM and Atari had made this relationship, and IBM had said, we're making these computers, instead of a couple years later saying, here's the IBM PC, a totally different beast.
Yeah, I mean, I have encountered that story. I have no reason to doubt it, so I don't have it in my documents because I don't have any date to associate it with. It must have been about 1980 because it was before the IBM PC came out, and apparently in that time frame, IBM wasn't sure whether they wanted to put out a PC of their own or not, and so they were thinking of various ways to get into the market, and so they apparently really did talk with Atari, and at least for a while, there was some consideration where the way for IBM to get in the market was to sell IBM branded Atari 800s. So that's about the story, the extent that I know it, and why it didn't play out that way. I don't know that anyone has figured that out.
Right.
But that does seem to be a real story.
And it does seem like it would be. I mean, like I guess we talked about this before, but I mean, it does seem like that would have had a big impact because the name of IBM suddenly means you're allowed to buy it.
Right.
And that's what all of us who had other computers said back then is that, well, the only reason people are buying the PC is because it says IBM on it. You know, it's the least capable of any of your choices, but that they're going to conquer the market anyway because of the brand that's on it.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Apple too. The Apple at the beginning, right? Jobs and Wozniak were looking for some way to manufacture computers, and it sounds like Atari had a chance to do that, and Atari said, "No, we're not really into computers. We're video game people. So you go do that off your own, and we'll help you out. We'll set you up with some financing and maybe some parts or something like that." But they decided, you know, they could have gotten into the market, the computer market. With the beginnings of the Apple computer, and they chose not to at that stage.
I think HP also passed on them. Like I think HP was offered because I think Wozniak was working for HP. And didn't wanted to give them right of first refusal or something.
Right.
That's right. I've read that as well.
So. Yeah, many different ways in which the world could have turned out.
Yeah.
So we've pretty much been talking entirely about the Atari project, but that's okay. Lots of people like are interested in the Atari, and we don't talk that much about the Atari on this podcast.
No, so it's good to have an Atari-centric episode. And like to take the opportunity because we have you here right in front of us.
Yeah, right.
And it's been really fun.
No, it's great to have a chance to sort of like talk in this depth about this. So.
Yep.
But okay, so I guess we can get back at some point. Maybe next time we can talk about meeting the PVP and stuff like that.
Right.
That we did earlier.
Yeah, but, let's do that.
So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. And you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, which we will read next time. We're a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Oh, yeah, we actually had to get it on time this time.
We did it.
Yeah. It works well when you can see each other.
Yeah. Okay.